Hey everyone, and welcome to the show. Have you ever thought about how appearances can be so deceiving? Like you think you know a place or a person, and then bam, something happens that just totally changes your whole perspective. It's like that unsettling feeling you get when the familiar suddenly becomes terrifying. And that's exactly the kind of chilling territory we're going to be exploring today in this deep dive as we unpack a truly gripping thriller. If you're intrigued by those dark secrets lurking beneath the surface, those hidden threats that could be closer than you think, well, hit that like button and subscribe to keep those chills coming.
So, are you ready to plunge into the heart of a small town where nothing is quite as it seems?
I think so. Lead the way.
All right, let's get into it. Today, we're diving deep into Chilled by L.O. James, a book that really gets under your skin. You can find the link to it on Amazon right there in the description. On the surface, it might seem like your typical detective story, you know, the setup. A detective heads back to her hometown to investigate some mysterious disappearances. But trust me, this book goes way beyond just basic suspense. It really digs into some seriously complex themes like the whole idea of trust, the lasting impact of personal history, and how even those seemingly peaceful small towns can be hiding some pretty messed up secrets. Oh, and the way Ellie James writes, it's like she just drops you right into the heart of the story. You'll be feeling those chills long after you finish the book, guaranteed.
All right, so let's get into the specifics, shall we? Right from the first page, James throws us headfirst into this super intense atmosphere. Think late winter in Bismarck, North Dakota. A brutal storm is raging. You can practically feel the biting wind and the bone-chilling cold. And it's not just about setting the scene, right? This harshness, this unforgiving landscape, it's like it mirrors the darkness of the crimes themselves.
You hit the nail on the head there. The setting is so visceral, it's almost like another character in the story. You feel this constant sense of isolation and vulnerability, which just adds to the overall suspense. And then we meet our main character, Brenna Jensen, a North Dakota Bureau of Criminal Investigations agent. She gets pulled back to her hometown, Riverton, because two women have vanished. But here's the thing, she's a native of the Northern Prairie, so she knows firsthand how long and how harsh those winters can be. And this, I think, subtly highlights just how out of place these disappearances are.
Yeah, there's this really vivid scene when Brenna arrives at the Riverton police station and she's like peeling off all those layers of winter gear, you know, that heavy coat, the hat, the gloves. It's like she's shedding this armor against the elements. I mean, it emphasizes how brutal the cold is, but it also shows how laser focused she is on the case, you know, no time for distractions. And Riverton isn't just some random town for Brenna, is it? It's packed with personal history, like every corner holds a memory. So this case is way more than just a job for her. It's a confrontation with her past.
Exactly. This is where she grew up. And more importantly, it's where her father was a police officer. He died a couple of years before the story starts, but they were super close. Like he was so proud of her following in his footsteps. And that adds this whole other level of depth, you know, emotional weight to her being back in Riverton. It's not just about solving this case, it's about honoring her dad's legacy right in the place where they shared so much.
And as if that wasn't enough, Brenna's also juggling this job offer in Minneapolis. It's a pretty sweet deal, you know, more responsibility, a bigger paycheck, the whole nine yards. But it means moving even further away from her family. You can just feel that internal tug of war, you know, between ambition and her roots. It's something I think a lot of people can relate to, that pull between chasing your dreams and staying close to what you know. And it's not something you often see in thrillers, you know, these characters dealing with everyday struggles alongside the suspense.
You're so right. It makes Brenna so much more relatable, so much more human. She's not just this tough, invincible detective. She's a real person with hopes and doubts and dreams, just like the rest of us. But then the case takes a sudden turn, and things get a whole lot more intense. Chief Burkholder drops the bombshell that a third woman has disappeared, and this time it's from East Riverton, which means the FBI is coming to town. And you know how local law enforcement usually feels about that? Not exactly thrilled. And Brenna's reaction is pretty much textbook.
Yeah, she's not exactly rolling out the welcome mat for the feds, is she? You can practically cut the tension with a knife. There's that line where she says, "I don't need outsiders mucking around," and she's quoting this old Red McCluskey, right? It really sums up that whole small town mentality, you know? That fierce sense of local pride and the suspicion of anyone coming in from the outside, especially the FBI. It's a classic conflict, isn't it? That tension between the people who know the town inside and out and the authorities who swoop in with their own agendas.
Absolutely. It's a clash of perspectives, of ways of doing things, and right on cue, enter FBI Special Agent Nick Tarver. And the author doesn't hold back on the description, does she? The black leather jacket, the piercing green eyes. It's like, hello, Mr. FBI. And Brennan's immediate reaction is super telling. She thinks, this guy's too perfect to be true. It's like there's this instant red flag, like he's hiding something.
Yeah, there's that instant spark, but not the good kind. Like, their personalities are going to clash big time. And Nick, he's all about smooth cooperation, talking about an amicable relationship and all that. But we know Brenna is not buying it, not even for a second. Her thoughts are screaming, liar! And it's not just because of her past run-ins with the FBI, right? There's this whole thing about her sister's perfect life, which seems to be fueling her distrust even more. Makes you wonder what's going on there.
Right. It's like this little glimpse into some family drama we haven't fully uncovered yet. And it adds this layer of vulnerability to Brenna, right?
Yeah.
It suggests maybe she feels like the black sheep of the family, which might explain why she's so guarded and distrustful. It definitely makes her character more complex, more interesting. So yeah, their first meeting is electric. Let's just say that. Not exactly the foundation for a great working relationship, unless opposites really do attract, right?
You got that right. Then we get this scene in the interrogation room. And it's super stark, just a metal table and a couple of chairs. No frills, no distractions. It's almost like the author is intentionally setting the stage for a power struggle. And Tarver doesn't waste any time asserting his authority.
He's all business, laying down the law, literally. He tells Brenna she's a liability and pulls her off the case. Officially, it's about jurisdiction and keeping her safe, but we can all see right through that, can't we? He's putting her in her place.
Yeah.
And it's got a sting, especially for someone as dedicated and competent as Brenna. It's that classic clash of ego and authority that we see in so many crime stories.
Oh, yeah. Brenna's not the type to just sit back and take it. She reminds him she's been on the force for 6 years. You know, she knows her stuff. And you can't help but admire her standing up for herself. But is she picking the right battle here?
You know, even though she's been officially sidelined, that inner drive to solve the case doesn't just vanish. I mean, she's got this personal connection to Riverton, and the fact that the victims are all women from her community, it just weighs on her. It's like she feels this responsibility. Then there's this hint of guilt from a past case. It's clear she's carrying some baggage. And Tarver, I think he picks up on her determination, so he asks for her help in a roundabout way.
Right, like he still needs her, even if he won't admit it outright. He asks for a list of all the criminals she's put away who are now back in the area on parole. It's like a small concession, an acknowledgement that her local knowledge might be useful, but it's definitely not a full partnership.
No, not at all. He's taking what he can get without giving her too much control. So then they start digging into the victims' backgrounds, and a pattern emerges. They're all single women who live alone. But then there's this detail that hits Brenna hard. One of the missing women is a psychiatrist, Dr. Janine Drummond. She'd been practicing in Riverton for years. And Brenna's reaction, well, it's not good.
Yeah, you can tell this is not just another name on a list for her. There's some serious history there, some bad blood, maybe. And it just makes the case that much more personal for her fuels her need to find answers. It's like this quiet confirmation that something dark is going on in Riverton, and it's probably connected to Brenna's past in some way. But Tarver, he's still all about control, right? He insists that Brenna watches the interviews from behind a one-way mirror, citing safety concerns, you know, classic overprotective FBI agent move.
Yeah, but is it really about safety or is it about keeping Brenna in check? I mean, it's definitely adding fuel to the fire. And Brenna, of course, is not having it. She gets super frustrated and starts pushing back. She even throws out an alternative theory, like maybe the guy who wrote those creepy notes isn't actually the killer. And maybe, just maybe, the women are still alive. It shows she's not afraid to challenge the status quo, to think outside the box. She's got that classic detective instinct, you know, always questioning, always looking for another angle.
She's definitely not a passive bystander, that's for sure. Then she does something that really surprises me. She goes to visit her sister, Alice. It's a reminder that family is important to Brenna. But there's this weird underlying tension, you know, like when Alice apologizes in advance for their mother's comments. What's that all about?
Yeah, there are definitely some unresolved issues there, some family drama bubbling beneath the surface. It's like Brenna expects her mother to be critical or judgmental, and this adds a whole other layer of stress to her already complicated situation. It's not just about the case, it's about navigating these complex family dynamics. And through Alice, we get a better sense of how the town is feeling. Everyone's on edge, worried about the missing women. It's like that sense of safety, that small town innocence has been shattered. And Alice, even mentions that Brenda's always been the strong one, the one everyone leaned on, especially after their dad died. It's like Brenna's always had to be the rock for everyone else.
And then Brenna drops a bomb on Alice. She tells her that the kidnapper sent her a note, which obviously freaks Alice out because now Brenna is a target too. And the fact that Alice immediately brings up Brenna being single, it just highlights how vulnerable she is in this situation. It's like those small town dynamics are both comforting and suffocating at the same time. And this new threat against Brenna, it just ramps up the stakes. But we also learn something pretty significant about Brenna's past. Those burn scars she has, they're from a childhood barn fire. And it's clearly not something she's comfortable talking about.
It's a pretty significant detail, right? It's like this physical reminder of a past trauma, of pain, of vulnerability. And the author doesn't shy away from the emotional impact. The way those scars affected Brenna as a kid, the cruelty she faced, and even as an adult, it's clear she's still carrying those insecurities, especially when it comes to relationships. It makes you wonder how much those scars are shaping her actions, her interactions with others. And then there's this whole thing about her moving to Bismarck years ago because of this messy situation with a married man named Victor. It's like she's running from her past, trying to outrun the pain.
Avoiding those difficult emotions, I get it. And then things get even more intense at the hotel pool. Brenna's just trying to relax, you know, get some peace and quiet. And then bam, Tarver grabs her wrist. And she totally flips out, knocks him unconscious. Talk about a dramatic reaction. It's like, okay, this woman does not mess around.
It's this instinctive, visceral response. It's like her fight or flight kicks in, and she's definitely not the fleeing type. It shows how deeply ingrained her distrust is, how quickly she feels threatened. And let's be honest, Tarver's behavior isn't exactly professional. It's like there's this undeniable attraction between them, but it's tangled up in this power dynamic that's, well, a little messed up. And then he does something that really crosses a line.
Yeah, that kiss. Totally inappropriate. And it's not just a one-time thing. He keeps pushing, demanding that Brenna report her every move to him. Like, do back off. It's clear he's obsessed with controlling her. And it's masked as this concern for her safety. The power struggle between them is just getting more and more intense. And then the case takes this really dark turn. They find Dr. Drummond's body.
It's in Eagle Lake, frozen under the ice. A chilling discovery. Literally. And for Brenna, this is a huge blow. It's not just another victim. This is someone she knew, someone she respected. It's got to be devastating for her. And in this moment of grief, we see a different side of Tarver. He actually shows some genuine concern for Brenna. Like he's finally seeing her as a human being, not just a pawn in his game.
Yeah, there's this softening, this vulnerability that we haven't really seen before. And then he does something that totally surprises me. He tells Brenna to handle the initial questioning at the scene. He's like, you're the local. You know these people. They'll trust you more than they'll trust me. It's like he's finally acknowledging that Brenna brings something unique to the table.
It's a sign of respect, for sure. Like, he's finally realizing that she's not just some small-town cop. She's got skills. She's got instincts. She's got heart. And their investigation leads them to Dr. Drummond's neighbor, Mr. Helmke. It's a small lead, but it can be crucial. And back at the war room, we get this little glimpse of how the dynamic between Brenna and Tarver is changing. Mm-hmm. Melissa and Paul are teasing Tarver about offering Brenna coffee. Like, it's this huge deal. It's one of those small human moments that just adds another layer to their relationship.
It's those details that make you feel like you're right there with them, experiencing it all. And then Brenna and Paul, they go to Dr. Drummond's office. And that's where we learn about Brenna's connection to the receptionist, Mrs. Keckler. Turns out she was a patient of Dr. Drummond's, too. It's just another reminder of how closely everyone is connected in this town. And it's in this moment, I think, that Brenna finally decides to open up to Tarver. She tells him about the barn fire, about how Dr. Drummond was her therapist afterwards. It's a huge step for her, you know, letting someone in like that.
It shows a real shift in their relationship. Like, there's a level of trust there that wasn't there before. Mm. And the details about that fire, they're just gut-wrenching. Brenna playing at her grandmother's farm, the smell of smoke, the terrifying realization that she's trapped because the door won't open. It's like this nightmare come to life. And the way she describes her sister and the other kids rescuing her, it just breaks your heart. But there's something that doesn't add up, right?
Yeah, that's what really gets me. The official report says the fire was caused by a spontaneous combustion of green hay. But Brenna, she remembers the door being stuck, like someone had jammed it or locked it on purpose. And that's what makes Tarver suspect arson. It raises this really unsettling question. Who would do something like that? Who would want to hurt a child? It just adds to this feeling that something sinister is going on in Riverton, something that's been festering for a long time. And then they go interview this guy, Bart Olson, who's a real piece of work. He's on parole, and he's got this major chip on his shoulder, especially when it comes to Brenna. He's not giving them anything without a lawyer present. It's a tense scene.
It definitely is. And it's a reminder of Brenna's history as a law enforcement officer in this town. You know, she's made enemies. And Tarver, he's smart. He knows that while Olson might have violated parole, he's probably not their guy. But more importantly, he sees the danger Brenna is in. He's like, don't underestimate this threat. You're a target now. It's like a line has been crossed.
And in this moment, something shifts between them. Brenna, she's clearly struggling with all this pressure, you know, the case, the personal connections, the threats. And Tarver, he does something that totally throws me off. He admits that he's made mistakes in past cases, that he's blamed himself when things went wrong. It's like this vulnerable confession, and it creates this unexpected bond between them.
Right. They're both carrying this weight, this burden of responsibility. Yeah. And then things take a turn for the worse. Brenna gets another threatening letter. This time they're super careful opening it, worried about toxins and whatnot. And Tarver, he goes into full-on protective mode. He books a hotel suite with two rooms, insists that Brenna doesn't stay alone. He's like, this killer is serious. We need to be smart.
But Brenna's not exactly thrilled about being babysat, is she? She wants her independence, but she can't deny that she's in danger. It's a tough spot to be in. And being stuck in that hotel room, it triggers something deep inside her. She has this full-blown panic attack, claustrophobia, memories of the fire, the feeling of being trapped. It's intense.
It's a really powerful scene. It shows the lasting impact of trauma, how those memories can just come flooding back. And Tarver, he totally steps up. He doesn't freak out. He doesn't judge. He just comforts her, creates this safe space. It's clear he cares about her, and not just in a professional way. But Brenna, she's hesitant to reveal everything. She's worried about the stigma, you know, what it would mean for her career if people knew about her panic attacks. It's sad, but it's a reality for so many people, especially in high-pressure jobs.
Yeah, the fear of being seen as weak, it's tough. But Tarver, he makes this promise to her. He's like, I need to understand what I'm protecting you from. It's a powerful moment of trust and vulnerability. And she finally opens up, tells him everything about the barn fire, the panic attacks, all of it. And this shared vulnerability, this emotional connection, it leads to this really symbolic scene. They go for a run in the cold and the slush. It's like this physical manifestation of their journey together. And then they end up at this park, a place where Brenna used to play baseball with her father. It's a bittersweet moment, full of memories.
It's like they're facing the past together, finding solace in shared experiences. But the investigation continues, and they get some bad news. Dr. Drummond's office has been set on fire. Arson. For Brenna, this is a huge trigger, you know, bringing back all those traumatic memories. Tarver's there for her, of course, offering comfort and support, but they get a lucky break. Mrs. Keckler, she's a smart cookie. She made a backup of Dr. Drummond's patient files and kept them at her house.
That's clutch, but they need a warrant to access those files, right?
Yeah, exactly. But Chief Burkholder comes through again. He helps him get a warrant from Judge Tyler, which is a sign that the local and federal authorities are finally working together. And they get some confirmation. Dr. Drummond's body was definitely found in Eagle Lake. But here's the kicker. Another woman is missing. Michelle Carmichael. And the judge, he drops this bomb on them. He's like, I think the killer is one of Dr. Drummond's patients. It's a game changer.
Okay, now things are getting really serious. They need to get those files, like yesterday. And as they race to Mrs. Keckler's house, you can feel that tension between Brenna and Tarver. She's so independent, you know, she wants to do things her own way, but she also knows she needs Tarver's help. It's a delicate balance.
Yeah, and things get even more complicated when they get to Mrs. Keckler's house. Guess who's there? Victor Greeley, Brenna's ex-lover. And he's not exactly happy to see her. He gets all aggressive, but Brenna's got some moves. She knees him right where it hurts, showing him that she's not messing around.
Ouch. And Tarver, he jumps in, ready to defend Brenna. Like, that protective instinct is on full display. And after that whole scene, Brenna finally comes clean about her past with Victor. It's like she's finally dropping her guard, letting Tarver see her vulnerabilities.
And Tarver, he's surprisingly understanding. He tells her about his own experience with infidelity, how his wife cheated on him. It's this raw moment of shared pain, you know? It creates a deeper connection between them, a sense of empathy. They're both carrying these scars, these wounds from the past, and they decide to call it a night, you know, get some rest, even though it means sharing that hotel suite.
And back at the hotel, Tarver's doing some digging on Victor, but it's clear he can't stop thinking about Brenna. He even has this crazy dream where she's in danger. It's like his subconscious is screaming at him, protect her! But then Brenna stumbles upon a clue that changes everything. She finds her sister Alice's married name, Klaus, on Dr. Drummond's patient list, and she's like, oh no, this can't be happening.
Talk about a family connection you don't want to find. It immediately raises those red flags, you know? Is Alice involved somehow? Is she in danger? And they also get the arson report back for Dr. Drummond's office fire. Turns out it was started with an electrical device plugged into the computer. Someone with tech skills did this. And then Melissa makes a discovery that chills me to the bone.
Yeah, this is where things get super creepy. Melissa, she's been doing some research online, and she finds these news articles about all the missing women, even Michelle Carmichael. They're all grouped together under this heading, Riverton Women in the News. But here's the terrifying part.
Brenna is the last woman featured in those articles. Yeah. Killer is clearly targeting women who've had their moment in the spotlight, and now Brenna's in the crosshairs. The stakes have never been higher. And to add to the pressure cooker, Brenna and Nick end up having dinner at Alice's house. That's where we meet Stan, Alice's husband, and their kids. But the whole family dinner vibe is ruined by Brenna's mother. She's so cruel, you know, making those snide comments about Brenna's scars, calling her damaged goods. It's just awful.
You can see where Brenna's insecurities come from, right? But Nick, bless his heart, he stands up for Brenna. It's a small gesture, but it means a lot. And while they're there, Nick starts chatting with Stan. Seems innocent enough, but he's fishing for information, subtly noting that Stan owns the local cable company, meaning he has access to, wait for it, Ethernet cables. And Brenna, she can't keep it a secret anymore. She tells Alice about the other missing women. Alice knows Michelle Carmichael, so this hits her hard. The tension is just so thick you could cut it with a knife.
It's like that feeling of dread is just permeating the whole town. And then, just when you think things can't get worse, they find Michelle Carmichael's body. She was strangled with, you guessed it, Ethernet cable.
Yeah.
The killer's MO is confirmed and is chilling. And as if that wasn't enough, the Red River is cresting, causing major flooding. Evacuation orders are looming, and it's just adding another layer of chaos to an already chaotic situation.
It's like the natural world is mirroring the internal turmoil. And then Brenna and Nick, they go back to her grandfather's old farm. It's a place filled with memories for Brenna, both good and bad. We learn a little more about her family, about her dad's decision to be a cop instead of a farmer. And there's this weird tension when it comes to Stan. Brenna clearly doesn't like him, but we don't know why yet.
It's like there's this whole other story there, just waiting to be uncovered. But their focus shifts back to the case when they stake out Robin Rutledge at the Riverton Bistro. They spend hours in the car, just watching, waiting. And finally, around 2 a.m., the cook locks up, but there's no sign of Robin. And when they go to check things out, they find the cook injured and Robin gone, kidnapped by Jason Conlon in a white Chevy pickup. It's a race against time.
They have to find Robin before it's too late. And their search leads them to this levee overlook, a place Jason used to take Robin. But what they find is chilling. Jason's truck is submerged in the icy water, and Robin's trapped inside, barely conscious. It's a terrifying moment. And Nick, he doesn't hesitate. He jumps into that freezing water, risking his own life to save Robin. It's heroic and honestly a little reckless.
Talk about a grand gesture. And he manages to get her out using his pocket knife to cut her free. It's intense, edge of your seat stuff. They take Robin back to Brenna's hotel room to warm up. And as they're caring for her, there's this undeniable closeness between Brenna and Nick. Like they've been through something together, something that's changed them.
Yeah, the whole near-death experience thing can definitely bond people. And they finally have that conversation about their one-night stand. Brenna tries to downplay it, calling it a mistake, but Nick shuts that down real quick. He's like, not for me. It's clear he's got feelings for her.
And they decide to see where things go, even though Brenna is still wrestling with her insecurities about her scars. But the case is far from over. The autopsy confirms that Dr. Drummond was strangled with Ethernet cable, the same kind used to tie up the other victims. They interview Jason Conlon, and he's all evasive and annoyed, especially when Brenna's around. He gives them alibis, but Robin tells a different story.
Yeah, Robin spills the tea. She tells them about Jason's possessive behavior, how he stalked her after they broke up. And get this, she mentions that Jason has mad computer skills. He worked at the college and at a computer store. So yeah, all signs are pointing to Jason. But Brenna, she does something that makes me question her judgment.
Oh, what's that?
She goes to her sister's house alone to help with the evacuation. Trevor's like, are you crazy? You're a target. But Brenna's all about family, you know? She can't just abandon them.
And that's when the truth comes out. In the most terrifying way imaginable. Nick goes back to the hotel room and Brenna's gone. He's like, oh no, I knew this was a bad idea. He gets this gut feeling that something's wrong. And he's right. At Alice's house, Stan, the seemingly harmless husband, he drops the bomb. He's the killer.
Mind blown. And his motive, it's so twisted. He blames everyone else for his mother's death, even though it's implied that he was the one who actually killed her. And it all clicks into place. The Ethernet cable, his obsession with those news articles, it's chilling. And then he says something truly horrifying. He asks Brenna if she knows how his father died, implying that he was involved in that barn fire all those years ago. It's like this whole web of secrets and lies is unraveling.
And he attacks Brenna, knocking her unconscious. Nick, he's frantic, searching for her, putting out an APB on her SUV. And Brenna, she wakes up trapped in Stan's suitcase in the back of her own car, bound with, what else? Ethernet cable. Thinking fast, she uses her cell phone's SOS feature to send a message for help, whispering her location.
Talk about resourceful. And Nick gets that message. It's garbled, but he hears her voice, her location. And he's like, we gotta go now. Meanwhile, Stan takes Brenna to her grandmother's old farmhouse, the place where it all began. And he starts talking about his dad, how his death wasn't an accident, hinting that there's more to the story.
Yeah, it's like every revelation just makes this whole thing more disturbing. And he keeps blaming his mom for everything, saying she turned her back on him. Brenna tries to talk him down, but it's useless. He's gone, lost in his own twisted reality.
So Nick, Paul, and Melissa, they're racing to find Brenna. The roads are flooding, it's chaos. And Melissa, bless her heart, she keeps things light with her Texan humor, talking about pickup trucks and all that. But when they get to the farmhouse, it's engulfed in flames. It's like a scene from a nightmare.
And Nick, he doesn't hesitate. He rushes into that burning building and finds Brenna. It's a close call, but he gets her out. Melissa and Paul are right there to help. They escape just as the floodwaters rise, threatening to swallow the whole house. It's like the climax of a disaster movie.
Let's talk about a dramatic rescue. Brenna ends up in the hospital, just minor injuries, thankfully. And her sister Alice is there, by her side. They've both been through hell, and it's clear their bond is stronger than ever. But Brenna's still torn, you know? Her feelings for Nick are undeniable, but she feels this responsibility to her family.
And Nick, he goes back to the hotel, and it's like this near-death experience has clarified everything. He's in love with Brenna, and when she tells him she got the job in Minneapolis, well, he doesn't miss a beat. He decides to transfer there, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big decision, but he knows it's the right one. And they start making plans to visit his family in Virginia, like they're in it for the long haul.
So sweet. And what about Alice?
Well, after everything that happened, she's given a new identity, Elise Johnson, and she moves to Brewer, Texas with her kids. It's a fresh start, a chance to escape the shadows of the past.
I'm glad she got a happy ending, at least.
Yeah, me too. But the story doesn't end there. Fast forward a few years, and Elise is living this peaceful life as a teacher. But then she gets a letter, and it's bad news. She calls Brenna, freaking out. It's like Stan might still be out there, a ghost from the past, threatening to destroy everything she's built.
Oh no, don't leave us hanging.
But don't worry, there's a silver lining. The story ends with this beautiful image. Brenna and Nick are expecting a baby. It's like this symbol of hope, of new beginnings. Life goes on, even after tragedy.
Aw, that's so beautiful. Chilled by L. James is one intense ride, and it leaves you thinking about some pretty profound questions, like, how much do our past traumas shape our relationships, our choices? And can love really conquer all, even the darkest secrets and the deepest fears? It's a book that'll stay with you long after you finish the last page.
It definitely makes you think. And that's what we love about these deep dives, right? Getting into those meaty discussions, exploring those complex themes. So tell us, what did you think about Chilled? What were your favorite moments, your biggest takeaways? Share your thoughts in the comments below. And don't forget to like and share this deep dive with your fellow bookworms.
And make sure to subscribe for more thrilling deep dives into the world of